Welcome to the Everyday Innovator Podcast for product managers, developers, and innovators. Your host is Chad McAllister, who gives you innovation training your customers will love you for. Get ready to take your career to the next level, for the doctor is in.
Hi, this is Chad, your host and founder of Product Innovation Educators, where product managers become product masters. How can product managers help their organizations become more innovative? That is the topic of this discussion with author of Innovation Wars, Driving Successful Corporate Innovation Programs. The author is Scott Bales, a technology and innovation evangelist. Scott has been a serial entrepreneur, a speaker at TEDx, and now runs Innovation Labs Asia, which is based in Singapore. In the interview, Scott shares a model for helping organizations be more innovative that consists of four C's. The 4C model, I call it the context, cultural development, capability, and collaboration model. You'll find the show notes with the full summary and transcript of the discussion at theeverydayinnovator.com/081. On to the interview. Scott, thanks so much for joining the Everyday Innovators today.
Thanks, Chad. Thank you for having me.
And I say today, it's almost midnight your time, because you are in Singapore, right?
Exactly. I'm looking at the clock right now. It's 11:46 p.m. As someone who works on every continent on the planet, you kind of get used to this.
Sure, no doubt. And you are involved in a lot of different things. So you're an author, speaker, and innovation coach. Also, I believe your day job here is managing director for the Innovation Labs Asia, which is headquarters there in Singapore. And Singapore is not a place I've gotten to yet, hope to sometime, and I'm sure some of the Everyday Innovators listening haven't either. Give us just a sense of what innovation culture is like there and just what it's like to live there.
Yeah, I mean, Singapore is an interesting place to live. It has a huge aspiration to be an epicenter of change within the mm-hmm. region. Some call Singapore Asia for Dummies because it's very Western savvy.
Right.
It runs British law. It speaks English. All those things that make coming out here very easy. But it's also, its neighbors are literally a half an hour's drive away. So I can go to Malaysia. I can go to Indonesia. It's a 2-hour flight to some of the most beautiful beaches in the region. Hmm. So it's a really great place to work. The government here is very pro innovation, progress, efficiency. And so you see things like its national airline, its national airport are continuously top satisfaction ratings around the world. And that's basically a culture they've had to do and build into society over the last four decades because they have no natural resources to sell. Mm. So everything is about how can you create IP out of nothing, basically. So they excel in technology advancement. They excel in service innovation. So it's a great place to work. It's also... I'm originally from Melbourne in Australia, so it's only a 7-hour flight back to Melbourne. Mm-hmm. And Singapore Airlines is connected to almost every major city that I need to do work in. So it usually means only one flight. Although on Monday, I'm going to San Diego, which requires 3 flights from Singapore.
Not easy to get to San Diego, apparently.
No. I have to go by Seoul, San Francisco to San Diego.
Yeah, that makes sense. That is one of my criteria when considering a place to live. I live near Denver, Colorado, and my criteria is I want to be driving distance to a major airport that will get me to most places in a single flight, right? So I never thought Singapore might be one of those places, but that sounds pretty appealing.
So funnily enough, I can come pretty direct to Denver via Moscow. Hmm. So Singapore Airlines flies to Denver via Moscow.
And you'll have to get over here sometime.
I would love to. As I said before, Colorado is a part of the world that my personal passion has an aspiration to come there. I'm also a cyclist on the side, mm-hmm. And I'm told that Boulder, Colorado is a place to go cycling in the United States.
Yeah, Boulder is a great place for the startup mentality. The culture there certainly supports innovation and entrepreneurship. It's typically in the top three. Well, okay, I'm kind of biased because I'm in the West, but I forget how much is going on the East Coast. But typically we think of San Francisco, Austin, Texas, and Boulder kind of, being the mecca for things going on with startup and entrepreneurship. And you also have Colorado Springs, which is the Olympic Training Center, and lots of cycling in the area too. So bring your bike and have to come out. And hopefully I'll get to Singapore sometime also.
If you come over here, Chad, I will take you out for a Singapore sling and some chili crab.
That would be great fun. And maybe I can get my biking legs back in shape. It's been too long since I've done any serious biking. Let's talk about your book. So Innovation Wars, this is a guide for product managers to help their organizations become more innovative. And you address several tools, you know, for taking the guesswork out of creating and launching successful products, something we talk about quite a bit on this podcast. And I want to focus our discussion on one of those tools, the one to get your customers to innovate for you or co-innovate with you. And in there, you talk about four activities, but I think you also, you shared with me also, you have this way of thinking about your model in terms of the four C's and the four P's. Can you tell us about that?
Yeah, I mean, so one of the hard things for a lot of, it's a product manager or an executive when it comes to innovation is, I mean, innovation to me is very much a creative process. Mm-hmm. And if you tell any creative person in the world to add structure to their creativity, they'll look at you very funnily. They'll be like, okay, then how do I be creative in a structured way? And so the reason I do this kind of the co-collaboration mentality is because if you look at any of the best innovators on the planet today, and this is everything from Tesla to Facebook to Uber, they actually co-created their product with their market. Most people don't realize this, but Apple still does this amazingly, where they co-create the iPhone 7 through leaked PR. And propaganda to basically get, you know, a sense on what everyone thinks on various product features and so forth. And so it's basically saying is that the people that lead the space innovation today are those that actually make sure they build things that the market needs and wants. Historically, particularly in the industrial area, a lot of people just built a product and imposed it on the market. A lot of that imposed products includes many of the things that we inherited today, such as insurance, banking, how retail is done, how publishing has been done, how education is today. We've inherited that from the industrial era. And if you look at the pattern of where things are happening, you've basically got innovators that are going out and saying, okay, in a particular industry, what does the market actually want? Mm-hmm. You know, what is the pain point? What are we solving here? What is the higher purpose here? And so the example I like to give here, so I'm a banker by trade, Chad, so sorry, a lot of my examples will come from financial services, is nobody buys a mortgage. What you're doing is you're actually buying a home. And so if we look at the value chain of buying a home, we know that you're going to need a mortgage significantly earlier, or that you're going to need to finance a home significantly earlier in that journey than waiting for when you might actually apply for a mortgage. And so if you ever look at Google, so Google on Google's AdWords, the two most expensive words on AdWords today are life insurance and mortgage. Why? Because if you own intent, you own the value chain. And guess who's the best company on the planet to own intent? You know, if you're going to buy a home, you're going to research a suburb, location, where, you know, where's your nearest international airport, where does it connect to? Google knows you're already making those kind of search patterns. And so they'll know, Chad, that you're going to buy a house in 6 months' time. And so essentially because they have the intelligence, they can sell that intent to the banks. And so what banks should be doing is realizing that the mortgage product they sell is in a broader value chain and look for ways to move up or down the value chain to create a higher purpose within that. Really, really simple example, and I give this to every bank. This is free consulting for the banks.
Okay, so if you're in banking, listen up, everyone.
This is free stuff. You already sell mortgages. Your strategic sourcing side of the bank also probably has a preferred relationship with some kind of logistics company for moving stuff around. Guess what you have to do when you buy a home? You have to move. And what is the most painful part of moving home? Moving.
Right.
So what if you just offered finance with us and we'll move you? So simple, yet nobody does it.
Exactly. I have another example for you. And so the tools that are kind of in this space, the jobs to be done framework, you know, is this great framework for thinking about really what is that value chain? What is the problem the customer has? Like you said, we don't shop for mortgages. Lately, I've been thinking about replacing a car, right? And so going and shopping for a new car. And one of the things that has helped me decide to push this decision off is I just hate having to go to the DMV, the Department of Motor Vehicle, to get the license plates and get the registration and all that. And I was thinking, why isn't there a car dealer that can take this pain away from me and make this easy? I don't care how they do it. I just would like to be able to purchase the car, get it registered, get the plates done, and have it all be legal, right?
Exactly. Your job is to buy a new car, not to register a car.
Exactly.
So I noticed you use the jobs to be done framework. Mm-hmm. Have you had Clay on this podcast before?
Yeah. So Clayton Christensen, is the one name for that, but he has a co-creator that put that together. And I wish I could remember his name, but
it wouldn't have to be Scott Anthony, would it?
I don't think it was Scott. No.
So, because Scott now actually runs Innersight on behalf of Clay.
Okay.
Innersight's global headquarters is here in Singapore, and Scott's a good friend of mine.
There is a site, the jobstobedone.org site, which has the blessing of Clayton Christensen to represent the Jobs to Be Done framework. And I interviewed the founder of that site, and his partner is the one that worked with Clayton in helping to create the framework. But the bottom line here is that it's a really useful framework to do exactly what you're talking about, which is think about the problem the customer actually has instead of what they're doing. And we talked through the example of buying a shovel, right? We don't buy a shovel because we're enamored with cool shovels. We probably have a hole to dig or something like that, right?
Exactly. Yeah. Yeah. It's the exact same thing. So people don't buy a drill bit, they buy a hole.
Right. Very good. So when it comes to co-creating or getting the customer to innovate with you, where do we start in this process?
So in the materials that I provided you earlier, I have a really simple framework that borrows from the world of design thinking. Mm-hmm. And that is using persona modeling to have a structured way of thinking through the problems and challenges of a consumer. So I have a four C's mentality, model towards innovation. And this comes under the third C, which is called capability.
Okay.
Capability is the tools and frameworks that you actually use to actually execute an innovation. And one of those capabilities is design thinking, lean startup, and the likes. And so persona modeling comes from the world of design thinking. By no means did I invent this. This is well and truly well before myself. Mm-hmm. But it creates a framework that allows a structured way to observe natural behavior in a way to know what to build and how to build it. And so the model that I use in the, get your customers to do the innovating is basically knowing, okay, what facts do you know about your customer? Who are they? Where do they live? Are they married? Are they single? What's their work, their work situation, income situation, those kind of things. But more importantly there is, what are their aspirations or goals that they want to achieve? So these are your jobs to be done. So I want to buy a home. I need a hole in the wall. I need to mow the lawn. That's their aspirations and goals. Mm-hmm. But the more important part is the two tangents. So one tangent is what we call pains. So the pain is, describe to me the pain or obstacle or challenge that they currently face in achieving that goal. And so that might be accessibility, affordability. It could be an intelligence or education. Mm-hmm. It could be a lack of technology innovation. And that's basically where you start getting insights of what you should build. But the more important part, and this is the one I always focus on a lot, is what we call early adoption behaviors. It's the behavioral bracket in the bottom left. And that's basically for people that already have an existing aspiration, what behaviors are they already demonstrating in an intent to solve their own problem? To give an example, everyone in the US knows Mint.com, the personal financial management and budgeting tool. What most people don't realize is where it actually was born. What it was prior to being Mint.com, it was an Excel spreadsheet that a budgeting community shared online, and they would update the code and all the macros behind it, mm-hmm. to allow it to manage the finances of a household. Mint.com was just an online version of that Excel spreadsheet. So they basically automated an existing behavior. Hmm. And so actually, if you look at almost all of the best startups of the last decade, all they did was automate an existing behavior. Instagram All it did was automate the ability of importing a file into Photoshop, applying an existing filter, exporting it, and sharing it to Facebook. Mm-hmm. People were already doing that. By automating it, you decrease the barrier to entry and more people can do it. So it's the same thing with Mint. By decreasing the barrier to entry to mastering the Excel spreadsheet, more people could actually budget.
This makes me think of the technology adoption lifecycle too, where we try to figure out what category might exist already that we're launching our product into. Or if there isn't one, then we're in that painful state of having to create a new category and cross the chasm, not crossing the chasm notion. So yeah, in this case, if you can identify the behaviors that your early adopters are already exhibiting, then you immediately know what category you're going into. You already have a target segment to approach with your proposed ideas.
I am so happy, Chad, that you just brought up Geoffrey Moore as a follow-up, because that would have been my next answer anyway. And that's exactly it, is that most people will wonder that if, okay, now I have an idea of what I should build and who I should build it for, mm-hmm. they start wondering about who should they be paying attention to co-create the product. And this is where the other role of the early adopter comes through, is the early adopter is an important contributor to the future of your product, mainly because they are already passionately and actively trying to solve their own problem.
Right.
And so I give the example of obesity, for instance, is if you look at Geoffrey Moore's model, you have early adopters, early majority, and late majority. Mm-hmm. Everybody wants to go after the majority of people that are obese. But unless that person is actually trying to fix their obesity problem, you've got to convince them they have a problem.
Right.
And that's the early majority. And so the difference between the early adopter and the early majority is an awareness and a self-driven intent to solve their own problem. The late majority are even harder, because you have to even convince them that the problem is even real and they need to even consider the possibility of solving it. So it's a parallel model to Geoffrey Moore's model around the message of marketing. And that's basically, in an early adopter community, you co-create the solution. In an early majority case, you go, look, these people have already solved a problem that you're semi-aware of. Mm-hmm. You can solve it too. And then to the late majority, you say, look, everybody else is doing this. Why don't you do it as well? And that's the adoption curve you follow through from a marketing message perspective. It's hard because the late majority, and particularly even the laggards, which are the worst, will resist the change the most. Yet they are the audience that most companies try to innovate towards. Mm-hmm. Because guess what? That's where most of the cash cows are today. So if you started banking these people in the 1980s, they are your cash cow today. If you started selling insurance to these people in the 1980s, they are your cash cow today.
And there's an important twist in here, that when you're going after that late majority, those cash cows, it's really hard to differentiate and stand out, right? So the companies that do that, maybe they differentiate on high quality, exceptional customer service. Maybe they're differentiating being a low-cost provider. But it's hard to get adoption, as you said. The customers already have their solutions, and the switching cost to them is you know, the friction involved in switching may not make it worthwhile for them to switch if there's not enough change in value.
More important, that they might not even be aware that there's a problem to solve, or they will be even resistant they have a problem to solve. Mm-hmm. I mean, everyone has a grandpa that has a habit that you want to change, and he's never going to change that habit. It could be any a dozen different reasons, but you know, he is his mindset is set into a certain era of adoption. And that's the norm for him. And so he is, by default, resistant to change. Funnily enough, and this is a good case study on this, is the fastest growing market on Facebook today is 55-year-old women.
Exactly. Yep.
And why? Two reasons. One, either their husbands have just died or they've just had grandkids. Mm. They're basically looking for social outreach. And the only way they're going to get that is by communicating on the medium the rest of their family is already on.
And I think that's a really good example and a point I was going to make to explore, which is if you want to differentiate in that kind of late majority space, is you can back up to find early adopters in that space that have a different take or a different twist on the problem. you know, like the senior citizen and the smartphone. You know, my mom would never have been an early adopter of smartphones, but as time went on, there was a company, Jitterbug, that made one for her segment, right? That really appealed to senior citizens because of just how the phone was designed and the customer service they created around it.
Yeah, and that's a great example. It's one of those things where around, particularly the late majority, their barriers to entry are significantly higher than those of the early adopter. And so you have to be a little bit more creative around how do you get over that. You said price is one way to compete. Specificity is a way to compete. Mm-hmm. They're just a very different market to the early adopter in any category.
Very good. So the persona work that you do, I like that these tangents that you add. So it's the kind of the traditional things I think about in persona. Just what do we know about the customer and their aspirations and goals? But then really thinking into where do they fit in that kind of Geoffrey Moore continuum? What are their early adoption behaviors and how can we, you know, really know what they need in a deeper way? If that wraps up persona development, what is next in your framework here?
Yeah, so the helicopter view of the model is basically the first C is context. So how do you structure yourself to be ready for some of these things? One of the biggest challenges, whether it's a small business or a large business, is they don't set themselves up for success. And this includes everything from financial structure, hierarchical structure, the talent that they bring in, the financial incentives they give to that talent. Because actually, you know what? A lot of multinational companies today disincentivize innovation. Their own performance management frameworks only work to perpetuate the way they do things now. The next is cultural development, and that's around how do you develop a culture of curiosity, experimentation, look at Simon Sinek's book, Start With Why. So how do you get people to ask why is it like this? How do you get people to accept that failure is actually a lesson, not a failure? And that's a huge cultural transformation piece to actually make people even curious about trying the new. And that's when you get to the capability side. So capabilities is around how do you use models like the persona model to ideate what I call strategic options. But then how do you create 25 of these and then evaluate each of them against each other as potential as different paths and options for the next year or 2 years or 3 years. And this is where you can start using models like Lean Startup, where you actually start to quantify the value of an idea through customer development and assumption testing, where you literally have a hypothesis that, okay, we want to be able to build a smartphone for 55-year-old female divorcees, and we can actually validate not only the viability of that idea, but the commercial potential of that idea using the methods borrowed from Lean Startup. The last part is really around collaboration. That's the fourth C, and that's really saying, okay, as an organization today, you have some core capabilities. Some of the capabilities that you may require to execute on a value chain to solve somebody's problem or their job to be done is going to require you to partner with someone with complementary capabilities. So the example I gave you before of the banks is they would have to partner with a logistics company who has strength in logistics to add that job to be done around moving house to somewhere they've just financed.
Okay, so that's your 4C model, moving from context to culture to capability and collaboration. And
correct.
I think we dove in, you said, into the capability aspect as we started talking about persona development.
Yeah. And the reason I tend to lead with that is it's kind of, like I say, it's the junior burger. It's the bite-sized thing that it's not too overwhelming to actually tackle and gives tangible insights into the process innovation. The hard part then is convincing someone to take a step back and realizing this is one small step in a larger process.
Right. And you mentioned lean tools in that mix too of capabilities and certainly is being used more and more by organizations. And typically the next step then, after we have a good handle on the customer and the challenges they're facing, is we have some assumptions or hypotheses that we create around that we need to start testing.
Yep.
Is that where you move to?
Yeah, correct. Yeah. So this is where we start. Yeah. I mean, assumption testing is basically at the core of the Lean Startup method. I mean, I've got a whole chapter on this, with basically how do you turn a model, so the persona model, into what I call a customer problem solution hypothesis.
Okay.
And so if we use our female divorcee smartphone model, is our customer is a 55-year-old woman who recent divorcee. Her problem is the desire for social connectivity to her family and friends. And the solution is a smartphone designed specifically for an elderly female.
Mm-hmm.
That's my hypothesis based on your scenario. And we go out there and we say, okay, what am I assuming there? First thing, we're assuming that 55-year-old women have any desire to socially connect with other individuals. That's an assumption. You know, we are assuming that 55-year-old women are actually divorcees. That's also an assumption. And so what we do is, by creating all these assumptions, we realize, okay, which one has the deepest, most critical impact onto the whole idea itself? And then we focus on testing that, predominantly through what we call customer development. So this customer development was originally championed by Steve Blank, mm-hmm. in his book, The Four Stages to Epiphany. Also with the work from Brant Cooper in his Entrepreneur's Guide to Customer Development. And it's basically just a scientific approach to doing quantitative experimentation with your market to know what works, what doesn't work. To basically give you scientific data to make decisions on, do I need to change something or do I continually persevere with the current hypothesis? I mean, I think, you know, Eric, who wrote the Lean Startup, he calls this the pivot or persevere decision. And it should be backed by hard statistical data, not driven by either emotional input or, you know, what we call the hippo decision. So the highest paid person in the room makes a decision. This should be driven by scientific data collected from the market. And this is why, startups, globally, are far better at producing impactful products, because when they test their assumptions, they test them with scientific data. They don't test them with emotion or with power.
And I know a lot of our listeners have read Steve Blank's work in Lean Startup, but not everyone's been through this yet. So can you give us an example of how that testing could actually get done? So you create these hypotheses around your customer problem solution. Now you need to figure out, are those assumptions right or not?
Yeah, so what you do is, by identifying one, which is basically the most critical, the risk, what we call the riskiest assumption,
mm-hmm.
You then design an experiment to test that assumption. And so let's say we want to test the fact that 55-year-old divorcees, 55-year-old women have a desire to socially reconnect after becoming a widow. And so that's our assumption.
Okay.
And so we would go out with that and we would deliberately look for 55 to 60-year-old women on the street. Some people choose to do this through traditional research companies. I find better results come from actually just doing this yourself. So getting decision makers to firsthand speak to the target audience.
Mm-hmm.
The best clients I've had on the planet is where I've had the decision maker actually get out and force them. I've had bank CEOs that I forced to do street level customer research, and it's amazing what they get out of it. So what you do is that they go out with a series of predetermined questions in a way to build two different parallel pieces of information. One is the quantitative side of it, and that's actually to drive the pivot versus persevere decision. The other one is the qualitative insights, which is basically saying, okay, when we go into the next cycle, what qualitative learnings can help shape our next decision? And so you go out, you get there, so you might interview 25 people. And we go out there and say, okay, look, if 50% of 55-year-old divorcees have a desire to socially connect, then we think we have something to pursue. And that's something you decide before you even speak to the first person. And if you go out and 20% and 20 out of 25 people have that desire, you're like, great, we're on the right track. We persevere with the same model. But if you only find two two widows out of 25 have a desire to socially connect. You've got a fundamental challenge now in your overall hypothesis, and you have to change something. You either change the customer, you change the problem they have, or how you're going to solve it.
Mm-hmm.
In early stage ideas, you tend to change the customer or the problem. You don't change, because until you have a problem to solve, there's no point solving it, basically. And so you might change, okay, well, what if we focus on 65-year-old divorcees? And that becomes a pivot.
Right.
And then you go back out again, you look for 65-year-old widows, and ask the same line of questions, and you might get a different statistical spread. And so what you're doing is you're looking for patterns that either invalidate or validate your assumption. And when an assumption is invalidated, you strike it off, and you have to change something. You have to go back and change your hypotheses. It's basically a circular model of saying, okay, I think the market is like this. You test that theory. If you're wrong, you change one variable, like a scientist would. You just change only one variable.
Mm-hmm.
You only change the customer or the problem or the solution. You don't change all three. And you go back out and retest. But if you are right, then you continue. You basically test the next riskiest assumption. So let's say, for instance, in our case before, identified two risks with our divorcees. One was they have a desire to socially connect. The second is, let's say they have a desire to use technology.
Okay.
So we find out that there is a pattern of 55-year-old widows to socially connect, but they have no desire to do it through technology. Again, that invalidates your original hypothesis, and you have to change something.
Right.
And so it becomes a circular model until over a period of time, you get so insightful on the customer that you're trying to solve a problem for that how you solve it becomes really easy, because they'll almost tell you how to solve their problem. And so through the startups that I've done over the last 8 years, they've all taken exactly this approach of saying, okay, we start with a very naive assumption and we refine it over time through this assumption testing.
And when you say that you go out on the street and talk to people, you literally mean you're going out on the street and talking to people. Yes?
Exactly. Yeah. So, I mean, I built a bank in New York. We spent a lot of time out in Manhattan in various parts of this various streets, literally engaging people in a discussion. I mean, I also did a lot of voluntary work mentoring startups through Lean Startup Machine. So Trevor Owens is also, he's been a fantastic guy in educating myself on my approach. He's the author of Lean Enterprise. I worked with his organization, literally mentoring 20 startups a weekend. They either in San Francisco or New York or Washington, Philadelphia, Singapore as well. I've literally taken him through this approach. And again, most people are as amazed as you just sounded. You literally go out on the street. You ask random strangers questions to test your idea.
Right. And I think when it comes to this kind of consumer research, market research, one of the stumbling blocks often is, well, how do we find the people that we need to talk to? And literally, if you live in the right place and there's lots of people walking on the street, this works. In my area, it's usually more reasonable to go to a coffee shop. And, you know, you just say, if you're looking for people, like in this case, women that look like they're around 55, you know, you just go up and you ask, hey, I'm working on this idea. Can I just get your thoughts on it for a few minutes? And you start the conversation.
Exactly. I mean, you're spot on. I mean, the amount of coffee shops that I've been kicked out of in New York is phenomenal. I think I've been kicked out of every Starbucks in Manhattan, particularly the ones around Union Square and Bryant Park.
Oh, no, they see you coming now.
Exactly. They know exactly who I am. They know exactly who's coming with me. And so they'll kick me up. But anyway, it's basically saying is you need to learn how to identify in the physical world your target customer.
Right.
And I coach people in the design of their questionnaires. Your first question should be a question that should either qualify or disqualify their data.
Mm-hmm.
And so literally in our case, you should be literally asking a question that would help you identify if they are a 55-year-old widow.
Right.
Because if they are not, their responses are irrelevant to your experiment.
Yeah, and you just look for someone else to talk to.
Exactly.
Pretty straightforward. Very good. So as we work through this process of doing the persona work, knowing who we are targeting, where they are in the marketplace, exploring those, really building the assumptions first, what is our customer problem solution and the hypotheses around those, exploring those, testing what we know and we don't know, you get to a point that I know you talk about learn and repeat. Yep. Tell us what's going on with learn and repeat.
So learn and repeat is what I kind of referred to before. So as you're doing very, what we call qualitative research, along the way, you'll also pick up some quantitative insights. And as you go around the cycle, you'll have to attach yourself to some insight you learned in the last cycle to shape the next cycle. And so that might be, for instance, that you go and meet this 55-year-old widow on the street and you learn a pattern that they're all from Brooklyn. And that helps you refine that you're actually now looking for 55-year-old widows from Brooklyn. Now, I can't quantify how many widows and how many 55-year-old widows are in Brooklyn, but you're basically refining either your qualification or you're refining the problem definition. And so you, what you do is you learn the quantitative insights from each cycle to refine your hypotheses through each cycle. You're not changing, you're refining.
Mm-hmm. And I know some people are listening and probably thinking, well, why would I want to refine to such a small group of people? But if we can solve a really well-defined problem for a specific group of people, even if it's a small group, there's going to be other people that recognize that solution also helps them with the same problem.
Yeah, and it's also important to remember we're trying to get to early adopters.
Right.
We are definitely not trying to get to the majority of the market. We're trying to get to an audience that is already actively trying to solve their problem.
Mm-hmm.
So through the process of, let's use our 55-year-old widow. Once you can actually regularly identify a 55-year-old widow, not that you can, you know, discriminate and say that, you know, the one in the gray jumper is a widow and the one in the red jumper is not. But what we basically have to figure out is the next most important question is, are they an early adopter? So once they qualify in terms of, yes, they are within the customer hypothesis, is do they have the problem? Okay. And hence why I was testing the desire for social outreach. And then the third question would literally be, how are you trying to do that today? And so if they tell you that they are not attempting to socially reach out to people already, they already are showing signs of not being an early adopter. And the reason we're those early adopters is because those early adopters are going to give us the insights to help craft the product and or service to meet the problem needs.
So any rule of thumbs that you've encountered, you know, if you're working in a large metropolitan area, how many people you've had to talk to qualify if they fit the segment? And then if they are an early adopter, any feel for numbers of people you've gone through?
Yeah, so I encourage people for every cycle to speak to every individual working on customer research should speak to a minimum of 25 people per cycle.
Mm-hmm.
And the reason I say that is because 25 is significant enough to start seeing a pattern. Statistically, it's insignificant. You know, if you speak to any researchers or statistics majors, but 25 is enough for you to start seeing an indicative pattern.
Sure.
To make your next decision. And remember, this is 25 per cycle. So to give an idea, over the period that I built a bank in New York, which was 2 years, I had 137 cycles. So that's 137 refinements on my hypotheses to get closer and closer and closer to my early adopter with the problem.
Mm-hmm.
And as a result, we then had a user. We basically had a collective community of nearly 2,000 people that had a very common problem and fit the customer hypothesis. And they then all actively helped us solve that problem. And guess what? Those 2,000 people then became our first customers.
Exactly. So it sounds like a lot of work to, you know, build up to understanding the product to actually develop. But you know at that point that you are developing the right product that actually provides value, and you have a built-in customer base to start with.
Exactly. And the best thing is you haven't sunk any cost in technology yet.
Right.
Because I often will encourage people, do not write a single line of code until you can repeatedly find your customer that has the problem and identifies behavioral traits of being an early adopter. Mm-hmm. Until you have those three things, do not even bother with technology.
Yeah, and even if we're not in the software space, this approach still works for understanding that, you know, job to be done, what is the actual problem, who has that problem, and how do we reach them? And then what solution do we provide them?
Exactly.
Very important. And I wish we had more time to talk through this, but the good news is this is going to be in your book. And it's going to be, because I know the book isn't available yet. So give us some information about when we expect the book to be available and how to find out about it.
Yeah, so the book should be on Amazon in Q3, Q4 this year. I'm in final negotiations right now. A couple of months ago, I completed a pre-orders campaign through a crowdfunding website called Publishizer that gave me the money basically to test my market. You know, and I applied the exact same experimentation models to my own products. Mm-hmm. That luckily enough, I raised enough money to bring the book to market. And we should see it on shelves in Q3, Q4 this year. The easiest place always to get a book, I'm not saying I'm affiliated with Amazon, but Amazon is always the easiest place to find a book.
Sure. And the full title of the book?
It's called Innovation Wars. Yeah. It's called Unlocking the Power of Innovation.
Okay. Innovation Wars by Scott Bales. Very good. And as listeners know, I always like to ask guests for an innovation quote towards the end of our interview. Share the innovation quote that you brought for us and why you chose that one.
Yeah, you know what? In hindsight, Chad, I've actually changed my response. Mm-hmm. One of my early mentors in this space was a guy called Will Evans. He works for the Library Company in New York. He's an amazing user experience designer. And he gave me a quote a couple of years ago, it's just also stuck with me, and that is, How will you know how to speak to your customers if you never speak to your customers? I think that's a really important insight that encourages particularly product owners, even people in strategy and marketing, to know that unless you are actively speaking to your customer, you'll never know how to communicate with them. So it doesn't matter whether you're building a product or building marketing to sell a product. Unless you're speaking to them, you're not getting the feedback you need to do your job properly.
Yeah, and kind of embedded in that, I like the idea that you just have to start, right? I think a lot of us, especially, you know, coming from an engineering perspective, we might not be real eager to jump in and start talking to customers about such things. But no one does this great the first time around anyhow, right? You just have to start.
Exactly. When we built our bank in New York, we were extremely apprehensive. Mm-hmm. And we figured out the easiest way to speak to people that are consciously open to a discussion about banking is, guess what? Go to any ATM queue. There's people that have literally 5 to 10 minutes to burn while they're waiting for their turn. Right. And they'll openly share with you that they're frustrated with their bank.
It's a good place to find people to talk with.
Exactly.
It's wonderful. Well, Scott, I so much appreciate your time and walking through your innovation model. Look forward to the book coming out. Is there anything you just want to leave listeners with?
I've had a really great chat with you, Chad. You know, I would encourage everyone to grab a copy of the book or to go to the book's website, which is innovationwarsbook.com. On there is the ability to ask me any random question. I am a global citizen with a universal curiosity, so no question anybody asks me is too random or too left of field. So I encourage everyone to reach out to me.
Wonderful. Thanks, Scott. Great talking with you.
Thanks, Chad.
Thank you for listening and for sharing this podcast with other product managers and innovators. For the summary of the discussion, check out theeverydayinnovator.com/081. Keep innovating.
Thank you for listening to Product Innovation Training Your Customers Will Love You For. To learn more, please check out the blog at theeverydayinnovator.com. Keep innovating.